Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of our cultural fabric, food folks and non-food folks alike.
One of the beauties of being on any reality show, whether you know yourself or not, you will get to know yourself really well when they're playing it back.
This week, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome one of the hosts of The Chew, chef, about to be restaurateur.
Our hottest is going to be Boom Shakalaka.
Top Chef contestant and author, Carla Hall. One of the world's greatest huggers. Carla Hall is one of the greatest huggers in the whole world. And I've experienced that hug.
I love hugging people. I call them a warm fuzzy. Hi, Ed.
It's so good to see you.
It's so good to see you. It's good to see you sitting down. Well, we travel. Sometimes I'm fortunate enough to find you on Amtrak going from New York to D.C. or D.C. to New York. So that's always been fun.
It's true. How we met, actually, I noticed you. We were on a really crowded Metrolinner to D.C. or coming back from D.C. And you came up to me because you said, "Are you Ed Levine? My husband is a really big fan."
Yes.
And
yes,
it was like
yes.
a complete role reversal. It's like, wait, I'm supposed to go up to you and tell you that my wife is a really big fan.
He totally geeked out when I got home and I told him that I sat next to you and talked the entire way.
So you grew up in Nashville. Your story is so interesting, and I don't think a lot of people know it. But what was food culture like in your family growing up in Nashville?
Well, you know, back in the day, and I grew up in the 60s, so I'm 51. We just didn't eat out a lot. We basically went to our friends and family. It was kind of like the whole thing of going to your family for Sunday dinner. I would go to my grandmother's house. We would go to friends' homes, and eating out was a special occasion. Or we would go out for fast food on Saturdays because my mother had us in all of these different activities. So that's where we would eat out. And I always wanted to go to the fancy restaurant, but we'd be going to the fast food restaurant. It was sort of in my teens that I probably had my first experience of hot chicken. And, you know, it was good. Fried pineapples, you know, fried food, fried fish sandwiches. You know, that was growing up in Nashville. Krispy Kreme donuts.
Now, what was the spread like at the Sunday family dinner?
Oh, so, you know, we would have a couple of different meats. So my grandmother would have some kind of country ham. And somebody that she knew would bring over the country ham in that sack, sort of you know, the muslin sack. And then she would have either a smothered pork chops or her baked chicken or like a roast beef. So we would have a couple of different proteins. And then all of the sides. In walks the sides that takes up the rest of the table.
That's awesome.
So we would have macaroni and cheese, of course. We might have some kind of green beans. And one of my aunts actually would do the French beans. And my mother, of course, if we had French beans, they would come out of a can. But this great aunt would actually have this bean splitter, you know, where they would split the green beans. And we would have some kind of a dressing. We would have a salad. There was always in the refrigerator fresh cucumbers and tomatoes, especially if it was in the summer. And my grandmother would peel her tomatoes. And
wait, she peeled
she
tomatoes?
Peeled the, she always like, peeled the tomatoes.
That's unusual, to say the least.
She would blanch them and then peel them. And then she would put them in the refrigerator. They would be cold. And she would slice them really, like, kind of like a half inch thick. And then we would have cucumbers and white onions in vinegar with a little bit of dill. It was always in the fridge because that would go on top of your greens, which would be collard greens or mustards or a mix with kale or your green beans.
So your mother wasn't much of a cook, sounds like.
Let's just say no.
It's okay.
Sorry, Mama.
Neither was my mom. You know, she thought it was counter-revolutionary because my mother was an old communist. So she's like, no, women don't belong in the kitchen.
Well, that wasn't, I mean, My mother went to a boarding school from fourth grade until the 11th grade. So I think in the years when she would have been in the kitchen with my grandmother, she wasn't. So she was at boarding school where people were cooking for her. So she just didn't, she didn't cook. And then she came home for a year for her senior year in high school. Then she went to nursing school. So, and then she got married to a man who cooked. Thanks, Daddy. Awesome.
And is, and was your stepfather a really good cook?
My father was a good cook.
Your father was
a good cook. Yeah, my father was a good cook. They got divorced at when I was seven, but they got married twice and they got divorced twice.
One of those complicated marriages.
I know, one of those expensive marriages. I mean, you pay for it once to get divorced, then you can pay for it again. But my dad is a really good cook. And my mother, they're still really good friends, but my mother still goes to his house because he makes his own chow chow pickle. He does greens. He does, you know, like sweet corn, you know, like the creamed corn, which is so incredibly good. He's such a good cook. I just love it.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So that's where the love of food and cooking came from. Did you watch him?
No, let me tell you, that's where the love of food came from.
Okay.
I've always loved food. But I didn't become interested in actually cooking until I was in my like mid-20s.
Yeah, because I couldn't believe it that, first of all, I'm always, you know, in the market for a new accountant, and you have an accounting degree from Howard University.
Yes, dude, do not call me. You're not in the market for me, because I, you know, I hated that job. Oh my gosh. You know, that job, and everybody who's listening, that was my safety job. I wanted to major in theater. I loved theater. I know you can't guess it. You would never know. You would never, ever know.
No, you're so shy.
I'm so shy. But I used to be really shy, and my mother put me in theater because she was trying to get me out of my shell. And so at 12, she took me to New York. I saw my sister and I were here in New York. My uncle was in a play, Bubbling Brown Sugar. And I loved it. And for 2 months, I reenacted one of these characters that was in that play. And I think that was the thing that sort of unlocked this creative side of myself. And my mother's like, theater. You have to do theater. And because I just started talking and I was just like, I just sort of came out of my shell. But I wanted to do theater. And then I wanted to go to Boston University. And I mention this all the time. They put me on a waiting list. I wasn't accepted. So I said, well, I have to leave home because, you know, I'm in Nashville and I need to leave home. So I went to Howard University and I majored in accounting because I liked my accounting teacher in high school. I mean, you know, how's that for a teacher influencing you? Teachers are so important out there. I love a good teacher because they can make or break a kid.
Yeah, because and he got you interested in a really boring subject.
Yes, yes. Yes. But I think it tells people, you know, I am the creative sort, but I'm also, and a lot of people don't know this about me, I love puzzles. I love, you know, I'm the type of person that if you have a jigsaw puzzle, I love jigsaw puzzles. You know, first you do the outside, but I will zero in on the shapes of the pieces. I'm the type, I can look at a shape, pick it up, and almost put it down where it goes, because that my mind works in pieces like that. You're looking at me like I'm weird.
No. I'm not a puzzle person, but I do know lots of puzzle people. My wife is a puzzle person.
Yeah.
So that must have played into your fascination with cooking.
Yes, yes. All of the, you know, how the ingredients fit together and how I will eat something, and I think, before I really got into food and I was traveling, I was modeling in France and I was in London and I was in Italy, I would sit down and I would eat something. I'm like, oh, what's in this? And so for me, it was a puzzle to figure out what was in the food. And this is when I became more interested in actually cooking, because all of the socialization takes place in the kitchen. Before, it was just, you know, parents, grandparents, dad cooking, and I was outside playing. I'm like, call me when it's done, ring a bell, I'll be in. You know, I wasn't really interested in putting that food together. But all of a sudden, I'm in the kitchen, and then I became interested, and I would carry a notebook to restaurants, and I would write down and try to dissect what was in there. And I'm sure people do that today. They go to a restaurant and they write down.
Well, now they take 1,000 photos.
Oh my gosh! You know, you're not even making notes. You're like taking pictures, dissecting it. The food is cold by the time you eat it. But that's really how I became interested, and I started buying cookbooks, and I started cooking for friends. And when I was traveling in Europe and in England, the way that I would pay people back to stay with them was to cook for them.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So how did you get from accounting to modeling, which I knew a little about, and you're obviously very beautiful? Like, I could be a plus-size model, I think.
No, you're not.
But how did that happen?
Come on, Ed. You know, I mean, as one would do, you're working in accounting, you hate it, you quit, you're like, oh, you know, I think I'll go to France. As one would do.
And were you discovered, or did you actually send pictures
it
around?
It wasn't even about being discovered. I met these girls who were in Tampa, Florida, when I was working for Price Waterhouse. And
you worked at Price Waterhouse?
I worked at Price Waterhouse back when there was a Big 8. That tells you how old I am. Now there's, what, a Big 4, you know?
Right, exactly.
And I got my CPA and all of that. It's hanging up in my mother's in her house in Nashville, as it should, because she paid for it, and you know, and that was
exactly
her dream.
Yep.
But so I met these girls, and I hated my job. My biggest fear was being 40 and hating my job, and so I said, let me just leave. And so modeling was not a dream of mine. It was a bridge between what I knew I didn't want to do and what I eventually wanted to do. And,
got it.
And I was happily on that journey.
You were modeling in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then...
It was over there that I think I discovered the love of food. And between being in London and Paris and modeling and culinary school, I actually started a lunch delivery service.
Which you did?
It was a total fluke. I'm telling you, I was on this journey to just discover and just say yes. I was in a receptive mode of saying, let me just say yes to whatever experience there is. So when I came back from, at the time I was living in London, and I moved in with my sister who was in Washington, D.C., a friend of mine who was in Paris had also moved back home to Washington. And so she was working at a doctor's office. I had done the food for my sister for a baby shower. I had made cakes and I did biscuits with smoked turkey. I did all these different things for my sister's baby shower. This particular friend couldn't come. So I said, she said, oh, I can't come. I said, well, I'll bring you some lunch tomorrow. And she said, oh, great, because there's nothing to eat around here. And I said, ooh, if you don't have anything to eat, that means all of the people around you don't have anything to eat. That would be kind of a cool business.
You're a born entrepreneur.
Right? Okay, so I just said it. You know, this is me. I'm an idea person. I need somebody to catch the ideas, to execute the ideas, but I do have a lot of ideas coming out of my mouth. So the next day, I get up to get the leftovers, and my brother-in-law had eaten them. I'm like, dude, you ate my food. I'm taking it to Patrice. But, you know, I am staying rent free. So, okay, that's his food. So I made some other things and I grabbed it. And I'm like, what am I going to put it in? I'm like, I see a picnic basket. I throw it in the basket and off I went to my friend's office. And I get there and she says, hi, this is my friend Carla. She has a business. And I'm looking at them.
Really?
Like, oh, what's the name of it? And I look down at the picnic basket, and I look back at the doctor whose office it was, and I said, it's the lunch basket. And he says, oh, this is great. So I dole out all this food. So now Patrice has to share her lunch with all these people. And then he says, oh, when will you be back? And I said, I'll be back tomorrow. So the next day, that night, you know, I go to the grocery store, I get stuff, and I go back the next day. But I also, not only did I go to that office, I went to the office next door, and I went to the hair salon, and I went to a barber shop. And within a week, I had 7 clients. Within 2 weeks, I had 14 clients, and I was the lunch lady for 5 years.
That's all, for 5 years?
Five years.
This was not like a few months.
No, I was hustling for 5 years. I bought a mail truck for $200, a retired mail truck with one seat. Then I moved from my sister's house. I lived in a walk-up. I was on the fourth floor, wow, walking up with my groceries and making food on tops of boxes. Highly illegal. I wouldn't recommend it, people. But that's what I did before I went to culinary school at 30.
Wow. So you went to culinary school, then you started cooking in hotels, right?
Right. I went to a French culinary school in Maryland, L'Académie de Cuisine.
That's right.
So I started cooking in hotels.
And then how did Top Chef come about?
By the time Top Chef rolled around, I was then a caterer. And I had a friend. I didn't even know about Top Chef because at this point, I work all the time. I have to tell you, I mean, without exaggeration, I pretty much worked 7 days a week, 12 to 14 hours a day. I was always working. So a friend had said, oh, do you know about Top Chef? And I didn't. And so I started binge watching. This was season three. I binge watched the whole thing. And my friend said, oh, they're having an open call. You should go. And I was like, yeah, that'll be really fun. You know, procrastination, procrastination, never do it. My sous chef said, oh, I had a dream that you were on Top Chef. I'm like, oh, stop it. You know, I was just talking about that with another friend. That same day, I had a call from Magical Elves, the production company that does Top Chef. So, oh, we're calling about Top Chef, and are you interested in doing Top Chef? We got your name from the president, and they were trying to say Les Dames d'Escoffier, Catherine Newell Smith, and they butchered it, so I didn't know what they were talking about, but I thought it was a crank call. I'm like, seriously? My sous chef says that she had a dream about me being on Top Chef. Somebody calls me that same day. I mean, come on. You know, it's a prank call. So I didn't call them back. And then they called me and I'm like, oh my gosh, it was real. So that I went through that process and then, you know.
I know. Isn't it weird how things happen? It's like when I wrote a book, my first book on New York food in 1991, I also got a message. It says, this is Florence Fabricant from the New York Times. Someone gave me the galleys of your book and I'd like you to take me on a food tour of New York for the New York Times. And I was like, which one of my friends did this?
Who's punking me?
Right. Who is punking me? This couldn't possibly be true. You know, but that's the way things happen in life.
I believe that. I believe that when you create that vacuum and you're open to anything, it can happen. You know, and I believe in that moment, that's when the thing is supposed to happen. Yeah.
So what do you get out of cooking for other people?
I think it's how I nurture people. And I am a hugger. I love hugging people. I love seeing people happy. I love giving people a memory. I love food memories. I mean, I think a lot of the food that I do and the inspiration comes from my grandmother and the memories that we had around her table and the laughter and the joy and all of that. And so it's something. And also because I talked about how I cooked for people when I had to stay with them and the only thing that I could give them was a meal.
Right. So, artists give paintings. You gave meals.
That's it. You know, you cook for somebody and you watch them be happy. I mean, I had some failures. So, okay, maybe it wasn't all smiles. But I think it is how I can give a piece of my heart to someone. And that's the joy that I get.
Yeah, I feel that. And I think the interesting thing about you is that comes across, like it came across even on Top Chef, which is not filled with real emotional moments, you know, but you oozed realness, you know, not sort of faux sentimentality, but because I don't think you're capable of faux sentimentality.
Well, no, I'm not really interested. And also remember that for me, I was leaving something that I did not like, and for me, I had found food. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So every moment that I get to do something that I enjoy, I am bursting with happiness. But another thing that when I was doing Top Chef, I didn't do it to be on television. I didn't do it because, oh, this is going to further my career.
But you didn't do it to become a star.
I didn't. I absolutely did not. I did it as a personal challenge. So when I was doing Top Chef and they gave us challenges, I would relate that back to me. Oh, ooh, what would I want to eat today? What would I want to serve somebody at my imaginary table? That's what I was thinking.
So your motivations were internally oriented, not externally driven.
Exactly. And I was such a sponge. And So when we were at the judges' table, whether I was on the top or the bottom, those people that were sitting there, I said, I may never see them ever again. So I'm going to listen to what they have to say, and whatever they have to say, I'm going to take that in. Because if you're on the top, you get feedback. If you were on the bottom, you got feedback. When you're in the middle, you get nothing. So I would rather, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I would rather be on the bottom than in the middle, because at least I get something that I can take home.
So you didn't get caught up in the sort of weirdness between the contestants. You were just doing your thing.
I was just doing my thing, and I really thought of us all as friends. You know, how weird is that?
And they didn't try to make you say anything mean. Like you were, your role was as the friend to everybody.
It was, but I think that if you think about the show and all the footage that they had of me, they couldn't make me mean, but they could make me really weird and quirky. But how far is that from who I am?
It's not a stretch, really.
It's not a stretch, you know? So I used to say to people, if you say it, they can play it. And I think one of the beauties of being on a show like that, and this is for any reality show, whether you know yourself or not, you will get to know yourself really well when they're playing it back.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, I know a lot of people like, no, they made me look this way. No, you were that person in that moment. They may be playing it over, but you were that person in that moment.
Right. They'll exaggerate it to increase the drama.
Right. Right.
So you even developed a signature line. Say it. Come on. And then you teach me to say it.
Hootie hoo. All right. So, Ed, this was a two-part call that my husband and I do, and we still do it. So when I say hootie, you say who. Okay. Hootie.
Who.
Hootie.
Who.
If I say who, you say hootie.
Who.
Hootie.
Who.
Hootie.
That's not bad.
Very good, Ed.
That's not bad. So that's where that line came from?
That's where it came from. And so it's a way that we can find each other in a store. But now it doesn't really work, because when I go hootie and I'm in a store, strangers say who.
It's an accommodation to being, you know, a well-known person. You know, you're going to get people to come up to you in a mall.
Yes, you do. You do. And, you know, I think the funniest thing, when people come up to me, there have been people, because I was on Top Chef and now I'm on The Chew, there have been people who will come up to me and I'm telling them my story. And they're like, well, I didn't know you were an accountant. And then a friend of theirs who's there like, I think you forget you don't really know her. They forget because they only know a piece of me on the show. And I think people think that they do know you.
Absolutely. And especially on a show like The Chew, which airs every day.
Right. Right.
And what's that like? I mean, you're with Mario and Michael.
Mm-hmm. And Daphne and Clinton.
You seem like you're having a good time. I can't really tell if that's real or not. But was it hard to go to doing that show, you know, like on a daily basis?
It was really, really hard. I don't think the part that's so hard, people probably wouldn't think about it, because basically I went from being on Top Chef, which you are doing what you do, and the cameras just happen to be there. So they're capturing you, that you're not interacting, except when you do those interviews, which honestly was just like free therapy for me. Thank you to all the producers for that. on The Chew, all of a sudden, you have a segment that's 5 minutes. You are cooking. You are interviewing. You are sharing something about yourself in 5 minutes. And that's very, very hard.
And they are really, they're down. It's not 5 minutes and 12 seconds.
Oh, exactly. It's 5 minutes. And sometimes you may think you have 5 minutes. I'm like, oh, we're over. You have 4:30. Okay.
Right.
So that was really hard for me. And also we wear IFBs. And that's a little thing in our ear where the producers are talking to us. So the first time that I had this little IFB in my ear, and the producer I'm making this dish, and he is telling me to put the egg in the pan. But he doesn't say that. He's just saying egg. And I'm looking around, and I'm like, what? Egg. And all of a sudden, he says egg. I say egg. Egg. And he says egg. I say egg. And Michael Simon is looking at me and laughing so hard, and he knows exactly what's happening right now. And I'm like, what? Just say, put the egg in the pan. Don't be cryptic. You know, it was so crazy.
He was giving you a clue to help you.
Oh, he was not helping. It was so hard. And it was the first year was so, so tough for me. And honestly, and I lived in a temporary apartment. I mean, I had the plates, everything there came with the apartment. I thought I was going to get fired. So I was like, I can't afford New York if I don't have a job. So every day I would come, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get fired. I'm going to get fired. Then I wouldn't move because I said, I need to be able to move from New York in 60 seconds or less, you know, if I get fired. And here we are in the fifth season.
That's awesome. So you mentioned hot chicken.
Yes.
You're opening a restaurant that's going to feature hot chicken.
That's right. Yep.
In Brooklyn, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. Red Hook, called Carla's...
Carla Hall's Southern Kitchen.
Right. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so, first of all, you said you had... You first experienced hot chicken when you were a teenager,
yes.
in Nashville. Was it at Prince's?
It was at Prince's. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so come on. I really want you to level with me. Have you ever finished an entire piece of the hottest chicken at Prince's? And if you are, I'm really impressed, and I'm going to give you the biggest hug because I don't know any other human being who could do that.
I have to say no. I have never finished a hot piece. As a matter of fact, the people that I know who finished hot, the whole entire piece of hot chicken, they were burning later and running to the bathroom. But it is so hot. As a matter of fact, I don't think Miss Jeffries, who was the owner of Prince's Chicken, if she knows that you are an outsider, she will not sell you the hottest chicken.
Right. She told me, because I was with the then general manager of Serious Eats, and we were at Prince's a few years ago, and Elena, the GM, said to her, I'm going to have like two pieces of the hot.
Yeah.
And she said, really? You don't want that, you mm-hmm. know? And mm-hmm. and she said, no, I do. I said, okay. She said, okay. And she gave us two pieces of the hot and two pieces of the mild. And even the mild, by the way, is hot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then I watched Elena take one bite. And then I watched her whole face turn red. And I thought I was going to have to take her to the hospital. Because
yeah.
what people don't understand, if they haven't been there, mm-hmm. how hot it is. First of all, it's not even brown like fried chicken.
Right.
It's red.
Yes, yes.
It's red from the cayenne.
Right.
Right.
And so what they do, they fry the chicken like any southern fried chicken. And then you take that chicken and you dip it into a spicy oil. And the oil goes from mild, medium to hot. And I personally think if you can eat the really, really hot, it should be free. But whatever.
I agree.
Me. Right. And so sometimes that fat can be lard with spices that they will dip it in, and it is red from the cayenne, or some people use ghost peppers, and so it is spicy.
So tell us about the restaurant. First of all, I'm fascinated by the fact that you crowdsourced the funding. I
yeah.
don't know about
well,
all the funding, some of the funding. How did that? Tell me about that.
Okay, insert eye roll. We did Kickstarter, and I'm really glad that I did, from the perspective that I'm all about community, and this was my first restaurant, and I didn't want to do it alone, and I wanted my fans to be on this journey with me. I got a lot of criticism, like, you're rich, you're on television, your husband's an attorney, you are an accountant, you have a book, you should be doing this yourself. And $250,000 that you're asking for, I could do five restaurants for that. Well, whatever. I don't know where you live, but
right.
No. So we decided to do the Kickstarter primarily, you know, as marketing and to let people know that we were doing it. And also to have my fans and the people who believed in me be on this journey with me. And it has been an incredible journey and a very long journey. So we got the $250,000 and but it's $1.2 million to build out the restaurant.
Right.
So
nobody could build a restaurant in New York for $250,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, again, insert eye roll. So, but the beautiful thing of this, and I cannot wait for us to have the founders wall. So all the people who basically pledged $25 or more, their names are going to be on the wall, And I get to walk in every day and look at the wall and see those people who believed in me.
That's great.
And it's pretty exciting.
So it's a community-based thing.
Yeah, yeah. And every restaurant that I open, God forbid if we do it again, because it's taken so long for this one, those people will be remembered. And they will kind of have a quote-unquote brick in the restaurant. But basically, it's a fast casual restaurant. And we only have 973 square feet. It's small. We will only have 26 seats. And it is chicken and sides. So
and mild, medium, and spicy.
Right. Our hottest is going to be boom shakalaka. And every time somebody orders, they're really hot. We have a cowbell. Like,
And are you going to give it to them free if they finish it?
Well, no, we do have to make our money back. Sorry, people. but we will recognize you. We will do that. All of the sides are vegetarian. And as you know, and I love all of the hot chicken places in Nashville. And a lot of them are, you know, some of them the hole in the walls. But it's kind of like a Nashville thing. And I'm so excited that it's become a national.
Yeah. I saw an ad. KFC is doing
hot chicken. KFC is doing hot chicken. You know, and so when a fast food place starts to jump on a trend, first of all, you know that they've been working on it for a couple of years. Secondly, I think for us, it benefits us in that they're going to educate people about what it is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we don't have to do that.
Yeah. No, that's cool.
You know.
And you are, in fact, a person who has always believed in giving back.
Yeah.
And paying it forward. Mm-hmm. And when I met you on that train, you were coming from a gig, I think working in a soup kitchen or something.
Yes.
In D.C., right? So
talk
a little bit about why you do that and some of the specifics.
Well, I think that when I got the chew I'm going to start there because they interviewed me. And they didn't choose me. They shot a pilot. Then they came back and they sort of totally revamped the whole thing. I went into a chemistry test with Mario, Michael, Daphne, and Clinton, and some other people. But I mentioned those four because we were together for 20 minutes tops. And then 6 days later, they announced us as the cast of The Chew. And I remember getting that call and thinking, oh, my gosh, what am I supposed to do with this? What do I do with this platform? And so I knew for me it was all about authenticity and to be true to myself, whatever I was going to show people. And also with this platform to give back. Because being on television, good people, just to be on television, to be quote unquote famous or a celebrity is really boring. Like, what are you going to do? How are you going to help other people? And how are you going to use this platform? So as a chef, I've always done a lot to help in hunger and a lot of hunger relief, because that's an area where I think as chefs, we can give back because we feel that we can fix this problem, because there's so much waste that happens in this country. Mm-hmm. I work with Fuel Up to Play 60 and Gen Youth because it's all about kids and teaching them to eat healthy and having healthy bodies. The Pajama Program is another organization that I work with, giving kids books and pajamas who live in shelters. I went to Mozambique recently with CARE. And that was such an eye-opening experience. Ed, have you ever been?
No.
Oh, my gosh. So it was all about, again, the global relief of hunger, but empowering people. And for me, when you go, you can give somebody anything, but when you teach them how to get it themselves and you watch them learn and you watch how their confidence just reads all over their face, like, wow, you're teaching me how to fish. You're teaching me how to have sustainable fishing
practices.
Well, that's
what's the famous line, right?
Yeah, right.
Give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish and he eats for a lifetime.
Exactly. So, you know, doing that kind of work. And recently I learned about an organization called the Helen Keller Institute that's been around for decades, but it's about giving kids, underprivileged kids, glasses, new glasses, and teaching people about the properties of sweet potatoes and the vitamin A and helping their eyesight. I'm like, oh my gosh, Southern food, sweet potatoes. I wear glasses. I think they're cool. This is a match made in heaven. So that's what gives me joy, is to give back and basically use the time and the platform to share this with people and help other people.
That's awesome. So, okay, now it's time for the special sauce 5-minute buffet.
Okay.
So, you know, we're just going to ask you a bunch of questions. There are no right or wrong answers, and I might hurry you along, but it's not like Jeopardy, you know, it's like there's no buzzer.
Yep.
So, who's at your Last Supper? No family allowed.
Oh my God, Oprah. I know, but I'm saying that because she's a Southern girl. Her father lives in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm also going to say Jamie Oliver because I love him. He knows I have a little bit of a chef crush on him. Oh, and Jimmy Smith, too. Oh, had just one? Okay.
No. There's multiple seats.
Okay, cool. Are you coming? I'll give you a hug.
All right. Okay. I'm there. So what would you all be eating?
It would be a potluck. And I want everybody to bring something from their childhood, one of their food memories, and hopefully, well, yes. So Jamie's going to bring something. Oprah's going to bring something. Now she's all into the healthy stuff. She's living out on the West Coast. And then I'm going to bring something like cornbread and beans, is something like stick to the ribs, but also a food memory. Who else did I say is coming?
Jimmy.
Jimmy Smith. Oh, my God. He's a chef in Birmingham. And he makes these amazing heirloom beans. Oh, what?
So good. He'd bring heirloom beans.
Yes. But I want a food memory because I want people to talk about why they are emotionally connected to that food.
Got it. Because that's important to you.
Yes, it really is.
So what's your go-to comfort food when you're stressed to the max?
My go-to comfort food, beans and cornbread or greens. When I am stressed here in New York, I try to get as close to Tennessee as possible, and I'm going to make something, I mean, you know, like in a pot, you know, so I go there in my head.
So you'll cook rather than go out and get potato chips or Haagen-Dazs ice cream.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not going to get a New York hot dog. I mean, I'm going to get something very comforting that puts me in Tennessee. Yeah.
Who would you most like to have a one-on-one dinner with, living or dead? Doesn't matter. Could be anyone.
Oh, my God. My grandmother.
Really?
My Freddie May lover, because she passed away before I really sort of got into the food world. And there's so many things that I want to ask her about recipes that I never asked her about because I wasn't really interested in food. So I want to bring her back, and I want her to be sort of 94 before she lost her memory. Okay.
Okay.
You know,
that's fair.
And I want to ask her, and I also want my grandma Thelma. I want my two grandmothers because my restaurant is an homage to them, and I want to ask them about so much of the food that they grew up on because that's also going to help me with my next cookbook.
That's awesome. All right. And what's in your desert island fridge? And because this is a fantasy, there's electricity there.
Right. I love it. There's a fridge on the desert island. We have to start with lemons because I love a good pucker. I love condiments. If you look at my fridge right now, there's going to be a lot of condiments.
Just condiments?
I have a lot of condiments. I have eggs and condiments and like soft cheese. It's crazy because I'm always going to want to do an omelet. So I have to have eggs. I have to have some kind of pickle and some kind of vinegar or pickly thing. And I have to have lemons. That's going to be, you know. And something sweet. Okay, some sugar.
Oh, yeah.
I want some sugar.
So, you know, because you actually also have a company that makes these really delicious little cookies. So, like, cookies, or would it be a pie or a cake?
Peach cobbler.
Peach cobbler.
Can I have ice cream because it's a desert island?
Yes. But... remember, there's a freezer in the fridge.
Oh, yeah, of course. So I want to have peach cobbler and vanilla ice cream.
That you make or that you buy? The ice cream. The peach cobbler,
no.
I know you're going to make.
I can buy it.
Okay.
But I want to buy it from a really good creamery.
So, like, Haagen-Dazs vanilla would do the job?
No, I really want some local creamery.
You want some local. Okay, that's fair. Well,
no diss on Haagen-Dazs.
I understand. So, yeah, just give us the name of the restaurant and when it's going to open, even if it's a ballpark.
It's Carla Hall Southern Kitchen. I've been wrong about the date every single time I give a date, but we're looking at the end of March.
Terrific. We can't wait. I will be one of the first customers. I will not order the hot chicken.
I accept.
Carla Hall, it has been our distinct pleasure to have you on Special Sauce and to learn what your special sauce has been. You are really not only one of the great huggers, but one of the great people in the food culture, and it's just been a gas. So thank you.
I will always order your special sauce. Thank you.
Thank you.